It is Tuesday, September 17th, 2013. My name is Sam Seder. This is the award-winning Majority Report. Folks, we've had a major meltdown, equipment meltdown today in the office. Two computers have fried their sound cards. So we will not be doing a live show today. All apologies. Instead, we will bring you to celebrate the second year anniversary of the occupation of Zuccotti Park in New York City, our best of compilation of the Occupy movement that Matt put together some time ago. Remember, the Majority Report app is going live on the Android and the iTunes market on Thursday. Make sure you go on Thursday to download it. Fingers crossed, we will be back tomorrow. We're going to spend the day trying to figure out what's going on with our equipment. So enjoy this best of, and we will be back tomorrow live.
See?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Seder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, December 29, 2011. My name is Sam Seder. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, my odyssey on winter holiday, the winter vacation as prescribed by the New York City public schools, my life no longer my own, dictated by the tyrannical Department of Education via the strong-armed, jackbooted thug that is my daughter, who's got her steel-toed boot planted firmly on my neck. None of my decisions are my own. She has vacation, so I must take vacation. And not to play video games like the good old days, but instead to be at her beck and call, trying to be a good parent, spoiling her, pretending like the world revolves around her, because it does. But enough of my resent, because more important, I am concerned with her future. And so it was very encouraging for me this past year, as we look back upon it, when Occupy Wall Street first began. As you recall, you people, you members, and sent me out to Madison, Wisconsin for that Saturday in March, I believe it was, where literally 100,000 people came into the Capitol, and people protested. All through the year, we were talking about the Arab Spring. We were talking about Anonymous and WikiLeaks. We were talking about the growing sense that people were expressing a disenchantment with the establishment. And it culminated in September of this year in New York, and I believe has yet to really culminate in its full culminationhood. Incidentally, I coined that phrase. If you use it, you need to send me 7 cents. And I think that will come over the coming months and perhaps even the coming years. But so we were very excited when Occupy Wall Street first broke. We were talking about U.S. Uncut. And I think it's through U.S. Uncut, I think we had spoken to Justin Weeds maybe prior to this date. I think we have spoken to Justin Weeds before. I'm not sure. Or at least I had been in touch with him, or his name had become was familiar to me. So we ended up interviewing Justin Weeds on the Monday the 19th, which was 2 days after that first day of protest in Zuccotti Park, after which known as Liberty Square, its original name. And our coverage continued and continues. Up to just last week, we spoke to Occupy New Hampshire. And so today we have a compilation of some of our coverage. It's not in any way exhaustive, but we have clips of we're talking to our own Jeff Smith, longtime majority reporter, Cedarista, Fanatista. He used to harass Mark Maron back on Breakroom Live on IM. We speak to him. We speak to Justin Weeds. And we also have a clip, our most demanded interview of the year.
My personal favorite.
And Matt's personal favorite, which actually fell on the day of the 12-hour show, which also happened to be N17, the two-month anniversary of Occupy Wall Street.
I mean, everything couldn't have added up better for this interview. I mean, it was just the perfect all-around moment.
Yes, the stars aligned, as it were. And I interviewed Fran Lebowitz, who's always been one of my favorite interviews to do over the years. And it was – I'm very proud of this interview. And I also, frankly, really enjoyed it. I mean, and so I think you're going to enjoy it. I don't think you can listen to this enough. I think she's very brilliant. And I think you'll enjoy it. It's very relevant to Occupy Wall Street and in a broader sense, a lot of things. So – enjoy this, and we'll also include, we may also include some other sundry clips from Best of the Left, and we'll be back tomorrow with a brand new, or at least a brand new, or partly brand new show, and it will involve, let me just say three words, year in review, four words, and Senator Catherine Harris. More than four words. And me. I don't think you need any more to show up tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen. All right, enjoy today's show. If you can become a member, please do so. Buy your coffee at justcoffee.coop. And, well, you know the rest. WikiLeaks and newspapers are not responsible for protecting government. You know, frankly, I think this is what you get when you have a U.S. government that has lied to its own people and to the world to invade Iraq and occupy Iraq. I mean, I think that's what happens. There was a day and age where it seemed like our officials said, hey, this is a bad thing to do because it will hurt the trust relationship between the U.S. government and its people, or the U.S. government and the rest of the world. And so when you break that trust, you lose that trust, and then there is a prima facie reason for people to do these type of document dumps, to do these type of leaks, because there's every reason to believe that the U.S. government is up to something nefarious. It would be irrational after how America behaved in the lead up to the war and how America behaved when the Obama administration came in and said, don't look backwards. Turn the page. We don't want to waste time with this. If you show the world that the American government is willing to lie to invade and occupy a country, resulting in the deaths of tens of hundreds of thousands of innocent people, and then with a following regime, with democracy working as it's supposed to work in this country, and they take no
not only no effort, but stifle all efforts to uncover what went on, how we ended up invading this country on a lie. This is what you get. This is what you get. So anybody who has an issue with what WikiLeaks has done should really take it up with those people who destroyed the trust between the American public and its government. That's what you get. From the Financial Times to Jeffrey Sachs to Chris Hedges, you're hearing people talk about the plutocracy, and you're hearing them talk about it in a way that would be considered shrill just a number of years ago. They're talking about it as an entity that is not just existing in this country, but because of their international nature, the plutocracy now. These people don't really give a shit what happens to our society. You know, there was a time that was some leverage. Hey, we got to do something to throw a bone to the masses, because if this falls apart, if we lose the middle class in this country, we're not going to have anybody to sell to. They don't care anymore. We have no leverage anymore. So what's happening in Wisconsin is incredibly important.
I'm Sam Cedar in Madison, Wisconsin.
The GOP in Wisconsin, the corporate media, and our leaders in Washington want you to believe that the country is bankrupt. And the only way to save us from it is to cut the pay, benefits, and rights of workers.
There is a big online war going on right now with our government and lulls. Security and Anonymous.
We're told that the financial crisis and the Great Recession caused by the filthy rich in this country have led us to a time where we all must share the sacrifice. And then we watch Washington give millionaires and billionaires tax cuts.
There's no denying this is the year of protest, as much as I think the establishment media doesn't want to talk about it.
Earlier this week, the Department of Homeland Security issues a bulletin, according to Computer World, warning the security community about the planned activities of the hacking collective Anonymous over the next few months. It's issued by the Department of Homeland Security National Cybersecurity and Communications Integration Center, NCCIC, or NCCIC. Warns financial services companies especially to be on the lookout for attempts by Anonymous to, quote, solicit ideologically dissatisfied, sympathetic employees to their cause. So if you work for a bank that is involved perhaps in this reinsurance kickback fraud that investigators have uncovered, or perhaps is continuing to robo-sign, or has been involved in all sorts of mortgage fraud, or actually has nothing on their balance sheets, and you work for one of these banks, and you're disgusted by it, and you're looking for some organization that might be interested in releasing reams of data about that bank, Anonymous is interested in you. This according to the Department of Homeland Security. The DHS alert also warns of 3 cyber attacks and civil protests, it says, are planned by Anonymous and affiliated groups. The first attack, dubbed Occupy Wall Street, is scheduled for September 17th. If you were to go onto Twitter, for instance, and hashtag SEP17 or hashtag Occupy Wall Street, you could get more information there. It is a day of rage protest announced by Adbusters in July, and it's being actively supported by Anonymous. You can go to Adbusters' website. I think it's adbusters.com.
Adbusters.org.
And Adbusters is a great magazine, incidentally. And that's where the protest is being coordinated. So, folks, if you on September 17th want to head down to Wall Street and cause some problems for people who have destroyed this economy, and have done it all at the discounted tax rate of 15%, if they pay any taxes, by all means, enjoy. I may very well be there.
And Sam and I actually ended up broadcasting live from Liberty Square many times throughout the Occupy Wall Street Zuccotti Park encampment.
All right, so we're down in Liberty Square.
Matt here again. And what you just heard was a bit of build-up to our first interview with Justin Weeds of the Occupy Wall Street media team. It occurred on our very first show after Occupy Wall Street began just 2 days earlier. And, I mean, looking back at all these clips, if you were to tell me that after we spoke to Justin on the 19th, that we would receive calls from our listeners, and not only those at Occupy Wall Street, but listeners who were live at encampments across the country, like Occupy Baltimore, Occupy Oakland, Occupy Dallas, LA, DC, Seattle, Salt Lake City. I mean, just looking at all these clips, the list just goes on. I mean, I felt Occupy Wall Street would be big, but it's just amazing going through these clips and just looking back just to see how big it's become. Following the next interview, we'll have some of our best of Occupy Wall Street segments, some interviews, and calls with occupiers like Jeff Smith, whom you all know as Don't Be a Putz. This will all end with what you all voted for as our very best interview of the year, and that's Fran Lebowitz talking Occupy Wall Street on N17. Enjoy.
On the phone from Wall Street is Justin Weeds. He is from the New York City General Assembly. Justin, what is the New York General Assembly?
The New York City General Assembly, and I'm sorry if my voice is a little hoarse. It's been quite a day.
I can imagine.
The New York City General Assembly is a group of people, a growing group of people who are committed to a consensus-driven process of finding solutions, of making decisions and taking action around issues that are critical to our social justice and to our well-being in New York City.
And are you guys, what's happening down there now? Where are you located and what's happening? Are people, are you guys staying there overnight? Have you been there overnight? How long have you been there?
That's right. This is our third day of the occupation. We are located in Zuccotti Park, which we are going to rename Liberty Plaza, its original name. And we have encamped now for two nights. We're on to our third day in this park, and we have no intention of leaving. And our intentions are to meet peacefully, to assemble, to exercise our First Amendment free speech rights and our right to peacefully assemble in order to address these issues and tackle these conversations, the difficult conversations that we need to take and to have in order to begin to make some real actionable decisions and begin to state some really clear demands about what we need to see change in our culture.
How many people are there, and how many people have been there over the course of the weekend?
So the numbers have, you know, fluctuated from day to day, but only in the sense that many people have come in solidarity during the day and then join us again the next day. But each night we've had at least several hundred people here sleeping, and during the days we usually swell in size. At this point, there are quite a large number of people here in the plaza, and part of that is sparked by the fact that just a few minutes ago, there was an arrest of a young girl who was chalking on our encampment. She was writing in chalk. She was arrested by the NYPD.
Arrested for writing in chalk?
That's right. Just a few minutes ago. And so people here are peacefully assembling in protest of that arrest, as well as several other arrests that occurred this morning during our peaceful march to Wall Street. Arrests that include arrests for wearing masks in the street, as well as arrests for disorderly conduct, where we have video showing that there was not at all any violence or disorderly conduct.
And
but we're very well documenting everything here.
And tell me, just give me a sense of what, I mean, what is the fundamental principle? Why Wall Street as opposed to anywhere else?
Why Wall Street? Well, Wall Street is symbolic of so many things for New Yorkers and for, you know, people all over the world. It really represents, for many of us, the symbol of a huge industrial collapse. The collapse of an entire, you know, financial sector that nearly brought on, you know, economic collapse. And after a bailout, you know, of hundreds of billions of dollars of our taxpayer money, We're stuck here with neighbors being foreclosed out of their homes, students like the ones that are occupying here with me, so entrenched in debt that it'll take them 20 years if they ever get out of it. And just a general, you know, climate of jobs and an economic climate that is not working for us, and our political leaders aren't making it any better.
And let me ask you, there have been reports that the police are making arrests of anyone wearing masks outside the park. Can you confirm that?
I'm sorry, say it again?
We've heard reports that the police are making arrests of anyone wearing the anonymous masks outside the park. Can you confirm that?
At this very moment, I can't confirm those arrests are being made. I have heard reports, I believe they've been confirmed, that at least one or two arrests were made this morning for people wearing masks in public, because apparently there is a New York City law that states that no more than one person can wear a mask in public.
And let me ask you this. How many media outlets have been interviewed at this point? Are there reporters from the various TV and radio outlets and print?
Absolutely. I mean, at this point, I see at least three or four different mainstream media outlets. We've seen Fox, CNN, ABC, New York One, Channel 7, PIX 11, many, many independent media. And we ourselves are sending our information out through our own independent media center, which we've set up in the center of the park. And so we are ourselves documenting very, 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 very closely and in intricate detail everything that's happening here. And we encourage all New Yorkers to come out and to bear witness to what is happening here so that we can hold the police to account, so that we can watch them very closely, and so that they know, and we all know, that the world is really watching what's happening here in Cottage.
And finally, my understanding is that a private park that you guys are occupying?
That's right. This is a private, what's called a private public space.
And has
privately owned public space.
And has the owner been supportive?
According to my understanding, the owner had given the okay to the NYPD to allow us to stay on the space as long as we were not disruptive and loud in the evening with amplified sound, as long as we were peaceful, which we have been throughout.
Great. And where can people get more information from what's happening in the New York City General Assembly, as you're calling it?
Right. So you can visit our website at OccupyWallStreet.org. You can also follow us.
Call recording off.
A minute. Through Twitter on the hashtags Occupy Wall Street, Take Wall Street, Step 17, and through my own Twitter feed, Occupy Wall STNYC. Occupy Wall STNYC.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Justin Weeds of the now established New York City General Assembly in downtown New York, just around the corner from Wall Street. I appreciate your time. Reverend Jay, welcome to the program.
I just got back from the Wall Street protest and just wanted to check in. The police are getting really creative because legally they're permitted to sleep on the sidewalk as a protest because of a recent court ruling. They're not allowed to put up a tent. And
right.
The police have interpreted this as they're not allowed to have any kind of a structure. So they've told everyone you're not allowed to have anything lean against anything else. So if you put down a sign at night and it leans against a tree or something like that, it's a structure, and the police are going to come in and with force tape.
That's stunning.
I think it's really important that you're going to talk about how the media isn't covering this, and I was really glad to hear you say that.
The coverage of this phenomena, if it was, you know, people sleeping out for an iPhone, would be huge. That's okay. You're not a freak if you do that. You got more respect if you dressed up as Yoda waiting for the last installment of Star Wars. Their cause, though, in specific terms, was virtually impossible to decipher. The group was clamoring for nothing in particular to happen right away, not the implementation of the Buffett rule or the increased regulation of the financial industry. Some didn't think the government action was the answer because the rich, they believed, would just find new ways to subvert the system. You know, that's a pretty hard idea to argue against at this point. The group's lack of cohesion and its apparent wish to pantomime progressivism rather than practice it knowledgeably is unsettling in the face of challenges of so many its generations face. Finding work, repaying student loans, figuring out ways to finish college when money has run out. You know, this is, and I bet you this Gina Belafonte is probably a self-identified liberal. She would never, ever have the guts to write about the Tea Party and how backward-ass they are. This time last year, I was at that Beck rally, and people were, I mean, I've got 8 hours of footage of people saying things like, I believe we got to live the real Constitution. I've never read it, but I'm going to take a course on it in October, and we got to have more God in government. Things like, there should be a law against passing any bills that are over 100 pages. That should be the law. Maybe it was 10 pages, they said. Or we need to cut programs except for Medicare and Social Security because I get those. Or, you know, I visited the Holocaust Museum and I saw what happens when a majority picks on a minority religious group. And that's why we have got to get this secret Sharia law that is infiltrating our country. And we've got to deal with these Muslims. I mean, I don't think I had a rational conversation with any of these people on their own terms. And yet, this is the phenomena that is driving this country. This is what gets CNN to report that a bunch of Tea Partiers are meeting in a Denny's to come up with their own super committee. That's not a joke, what I just said. CNN's literally covering a meeting of some Tea Partiers in a Denny's in Florida. And the only reporting as of Friday morning from the New York Times is that there's some people there who seem to be rather extreme, and they don't seem to have a clear legislative agenda for what they're pushing. Show me the protest about the lack of accountability of Wall Street that has brought about any real accountability. Show me the moves by government. Or by well-funded advocacy groups that has. Show me. And I want to talk about this piece from Andrew Ross Sorkin in the New York Times. This guy is, I don't want to say he's a mouthpiece for the financial industry, but let me let his writing speak for itself. The title of his piece is On Wall Street, A Protest Matures. Has the protest matured? I mean, what's the implication? When they started out, they were little babies. They were little kids, and now they're growing. They're growing up, and they're getting a little bit better. It's an interesting choice of words. Because the other way you could frame this is, I'm starting to understand what they're talking about. Or they're gaining more and more power. Not that they're growing up. And they're getting all big now. This is the way they diminish this, the protesters. They've gone from elementary schools to now they're tweeners or adolescents. They're maturing. And he writes, I had gone down to Zuccotti Park to see the activist movement firsthand after getting a call from the chief executive of a major bank last week before nearly 700 people were arrested over the weekend during a demonstration on the Brooklyn Bridge. Is this Occupy Wall Street thing a big deal? The CEO asked me. I didn't have an answer. CEO said, we're trying to figure out how much we should be worried about all of this. He continued, clearly concerned. Is this going to turn into a personal safety problem? Okay, there's a couple of things that we should note here in this exchange. One, Andrew Ross Sorkin doesn't cover anything unless a bank CEO says, hey, will you do me a favor and run down there and check it out for me? Oh, yeah, it hadn't even occurred to me to do that. But now that you think it's important, well, then I guess I should go down there. Hadn't occurred to me to go and check out this hundreds of people, these thousands of people who are protesting on my beat. Just hadn't occurred to me until I got the call from the CEO. And then I'm going to relate your paranoia about your personal safety as if that's not paranoid. That's not crazy. That's not immature. That's a perfectly normal response by one of you, right? I mean, if I was writing this, I'd go, you're not going to believe this, but a bank president called me saying, I'm afraid for my life because there are people down there doing a drum circle. But that's not the way we do it. The response from the bank CEO, and the interesting thing is, I mean, the thing that I appreciated is at least they're worried about it. But the only thing that they're worried about right now is my own personal safety. I'm not worried that this might actually push a movement for accountability, at least according to Andrew Ross Sorkin, right? I mean, Andrew Ross Sorkin made a point of putting in this thing. He's afraid of his personal safety. He's not afraid of any type of accountability because his banks have been engaged in fraud or took huge bailout money from the taxpayers and have screwed over our economy. That he's not afraid of. He's afraid of his personal safety. So I'm going to call a financial reporter at the New York Times. I don't even know if Andrew Ross Sorkin is aware of just how corrupt his own words make him seem, or if he has just been in such an environment that that actually is going to benefit him. He thinks it's going to benefit him, and it very well may. Hey, I just want to put it out there for any bank CEOs. I'm your go-to errand boy. If you need to get an assessment as to whether or not they're going to those pitchforks and torches are going to come to your house, give me a call. I'm here for you guys. As I wandered around the park, it was clear to me that most bankers probably don't have to worry about being in imminent personal danger. As if that's the issue, right? This didn't seem like a brutal group. At least not yet. Well, I got news for you. If I'm a bank CEO, or if you're a bank CEO, I hope you're pooping your pants. Apparently, the people at CNN have a real problem with this. Some of those financial people really have a real stunning problem with this. You know, we talked about Aaron Ross Sorkin, you know, heading down to Occupy Wall Street because some bank CEO told him to. Here's the piece. I hadn't heard this part about Erin Burnett. I know she had tweeted, but I didn't realize she has a segment called Seriously? Am I wrong? I mean, because I never watch Saturday Night Live anymore, but is that... Do you watch Saturday Night Live? Do you watch Saturday Night Live?
I do. That sounds to me like a certain segment on SNL, yes.
Isn't that the, like, what's-his-face's...
Yeah.
I can't remember his name.
Yeah, Seth Meyers.
Right, yes. He has a thing where his whole joke... named on Friday, but
that's still a lazy conceit.
That's more like a radio conceit. Like, that's something I'll do. Like, seriously? You know, that's his joke setup. And so she does this, I guess, thinking like, well, if he does it, boy, she's bad. But aside from being bad, she also seems to be, I don't know. I guess the jury's out. She's either an idiot or just a huge liar. And I'm going to go with, well, this also could be just enormously lazy and too self-satisfied. It's probably a combination of all three. I'm not sure if we see all three in this clip, but let's play this clip. This is Erin Burnett. This is just a day and a half ago, I guess. I've completely lost sense of time. Erin Burnett headed down to Occupy Wall Street. She shot, like, look, we were down there. We saw this guy who's in this clip, actually. He was hanging out when we were interviewing Naomi Klein.
He was probably standing a foot from Naomi Klein listening in to our show live.
Yeah. Yes. And are there people there who look a little freaky or wearing funny glasses? Yes. And I would say the percentage of those people relative to the entire size of the crowd is somewhere between 1 and 3%. So here is Erin Burnett doing this serious report. She goes down there and she really fakes out this ad sales guy or this former marketing guy or computer software developer. But let's listen to this clip.
Now for a story that made us say, seriously? The Occupy Wall Street protest entered its third week today. What started as less than a dozen college students camping out in a park near the New York Stock Exchange is now hundreds of protesters. And it's spread to other cities. But what are they protesting? Nobody seems to know. So this afternoon, we went to Wall Street to find out.
Nobody's 3 weeks into this, she's saying, and nobody seems to know? When was this? This is 2 days ago, right?
Yes.
And she's claiming that nobody seems to know. She has a very, she apparently has either a very limited social and news circle. You know, I mean, she could have said, like, some people think they have an idea, or there's some places where you can say, but nobody seems to know. Nobody. 3 weeks into it. That's stunning. In fact, I think you'd be hard pressed to find somebody who could actually say, nobody seems to know anymore. You know, I mean, if she had done this 3 weeks ago.
I mean, even that bank CEO who told Andrew Ross Sorkin to get down there seemed to have a better grasp of what was going on
That's
than
a very good
than
point.
Her.
That's a very good point. Maybe she should get Andrew Ross Sorkin's, Rolodex and call that bank CEO to ask him.
And despite what you heard, here's what I saw. It's not just a bunch of dancing hippies protesting. There are all kinds of people there. Babies, teachers, cheerleaders, Uncle Sampta, and that.
She was talking about a human being, incidentally, if you're not seeing the picture. But aside from that, you see the sort of the rhetorical little game she plays here? It's not just a bunch of hippies. There's also a bunch of other freaks and teachers. Right? There's cheerleaders and that and teachers. So it's not just hippies, folks. I don't want you to think I'm judging. It's not just hippies. There's also a bunch of freaks and teachers.
Seriously, it's a mixed bag, but they were happy to take some time from their books, banjos, bongos, sports drinks, catered lunch. Yeah, there was catered lunch.
Oh my God, not catered lunch. You mean people have to eat?
Oh, there's a catered lunch as opposed to what? It's not a home-cooked meal that they're doing in the park. I mean, there's no Bunsen burners there. No, they bought pizza from across the street, or people sent them pizza. It's not a catered lunch. It is stunning. Keep going.
I also like how she says banjos like this. Banjos? Like she has no idea how to say the word.
Right. Weird instruments.
Designer yoga clothing. That's a Lululemon logo. Computers. Lots of MacBooks. And phones to help us get to the bottom of it. This is unemployed software developer Dan. What do you do for a living?
I'm a software developer.
Software developer.
Yes.
So currently employed or unemployed?
Unemployed.
Unemployed.
Unemployed, we like to call it.
Unemployed.
It's called Occupy Wall Street.
So do you know that taxpayers actually made money on the Wall Street bailout?
I was unaware of that.
They did. They made, not on GM, but they did on the Wall Street part of the bailout.
Okay.
Does that make you feel any differently?
Well, I would have to do more research about it, but...
if I were right, it might.
Oh, sure.
All right, this person is, and this is where obviously she's just lying or she's just stupid. And I would imagine, and these things aren't mutually exclusive, to be fair. She could be lying and she could be stupid. She could be willfully ignorant. But she really wanted to go down there and prove how clueless these people were. There's no reason to be mad at Wall Street. Now, GM, on the other hand... You could be mad at GM, but not Wall Street, which I got to say is fairly coincidental, because here's a statement by way of Will Bunch and Brian Hickey of the local Independence Tea Party and what they have to say about Occupy Wall Street. Because the implication here that she's saying is that bailing out the banks was a great idea. But GM, we didn't make any money on that. But wonder where she got that concept from. Wonder where she got that sort of like that, I don't know if I would call it a talking point. The idea that Wall Street is the root of all evil is also an anathema to us. Like any other institution, Wall Street has its corrupt figures, and such individuals should be dealt with accordingly. But to condemn Wall Street en masse is akin to condemning our entire free enterprise system. Our association deplores corporate bailouts. GM. They're talking about GM. Corporate subsidies, Solyndra, and corporate welfare. Now, of course, we know that Solyndra and any solar subsidies are literally 2%. Of all the subsidies we give to energy, whether it's $50 billion for nuclear power, for another $10, $20 billion for coal, and another $10, $20 billion for oil subsidies. But it's the $500,000 loan or the $1.5 million loan to Solyndra. That was the big problem. At the same time, however, we recognize the contributions and achievements of America's Chamber of Commerce. She's parroting the talking points of these Tea Party people. I guess that's not to be surprised.
Seriously? That's all it would take to put an end to the unrest. Well, as promised, we did go double-check the numbers on the bank bailout, and this is what we found. Yes, the bank bailouts made money for American taxpayers right now to the tune of $10 billion, anticipated that it will be $20 billion. Those are seriously the numbers. And this was the big issue, so we solved it. In fact, the only reason we haven't made all the TARP money back is actually GM. But I don't see any protests in Detroit.
So there it is. And GM, probably, I think we're going to see the money. In fact, I think if you look at market capitalization, we probably have made money. We just haven't sold all the stock in there. But that's aside from the point, because she conflates bank bailouts with TARP. Yes, TARP was one element of the bank bailouts, but there was TALF, which is that short-term asset-backed securities loan facility, which essentially, there was a whole series of different instruments that allowed banks to borrow money from the Fed at 0% interest. And then what they did is turned around and loaned that money back to us at 1, 2, 3, 4% interest by buying U.S. Treasury bonds. So in other words, and we've talked about this many times, Matt, let me borrow $10. Okay, you give me $10. And you come to me and go, hey, can I borrow $10? Sure can. Just give me $11 tomorrow. You give me that $11, and then I give you back the 10 that I borrowed from you, and I have a buck. And I've just made a buck off of you, Matt. And you, in this instance, you are the taxpayer. Apparently, Erin Burnett, didn't she work on, like, CNBC? Didn't she work for, like, some financial channel? She couldn't figure that out. We also know the billions of dollars that was sent to AIG was basically a slush fund for other banks, particularly Goldman Sachs. We also know that we allowed the Bank of America to sell a bunch of their crappy mortgages to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So there's anywhere, I mean, the figures range from anywhere from like $1.5 to $3 trillion that have been spent on these bank bailouts. So the notion that it didn't cost any taxpayers any money is ridiculous, but that's not even relevant anyways. Because even if the bailouts cost no money, even if we made $10 billion on the bailouts, we still have a completely broken financial system because of the excessive leveraging and speculation these banks did, and it has destroyed the economy. There are, depending on how you calculate it, over 20 million people unemployed. There are millions of people whose mortgages are underwater. There are millions of people who have been subjected to mortgage fraud. There is ongoing mortgage fraud. So forget about the bailouts. Wall Street ruined our economy. Ruined our economy. The financialization of our economy is ruining our economy. The income disparity is ruining our economy. But Erin Burnett found it more convenient to just reduce it down to, did we make money on TARP?
You know, I find it interesting. If you're watching the video, which I'll probably put this one up on our YouTube for the day, you can when she asks him a question and he says, well, it's called Occupy Wall Street, there's a really quick clip of the park being on Liberty Street, as if to laugh at them saying, well, you're not on Wall Street, you're on Liberty Street. It's like little things like that. Throughout the whole video,
right,
there's little things like that just
you couldn't
peppered
sit down.
Throughout.
Yeah, you couldn't sit down. If you were making a hit piece on this, you couldn't sit down and do it better.
And they found a supporter who, unfortunately, I mean, not everyone is going to be as knowledgeable on all this as some, like, for example, that guy who took down Fox News, Jesse LaGreca. This guy, unfortunately, he just didn't know as much as maybe someone else knows, and they went out of their way to find someone like
that.
He
was smart enough to say, you know what, I don't believe you. Let me check. I need to do more research on it.
Yep.
But if I wasn't lying and a shill for the banking industry and was telling you the truth, would I be right? Oh, we solved it. What a moron. You know what? I'm going to make a prediction. Those people are going to be in that park longer than she will have a program on CNN. All right, so let me get to this story by the Daily News op-ed, not signed by anybody. Anything that might convince the precious insufferables who have taken over Wall Street that they have had enough of exercising their First Amendment rights to the inconvenience of tens of thousands of people who actually have to work for a living. This bunch ought to get down on their knees and thanks that America's capitalist founding fathers saw it fit to protect the privileges. The privileges. It's not a right anymore. Remember, it was all about the Constitution yesterday, but today it's a privilege of the dumb and obnoxious along with everyone else. If the NYPD has made any tactical error in this episode, it was being too tolerant. Police also closed major intersection to traffic, forcing pedestrians to take the long way around. Further, and this is horrible. This is going to, folks, if you have children, again, please cover their ears. Further, the cops cordoned off the statue of the Wall Street Bull, depriving tourists of up-close and personal inspections.
For those who want an up-close...
Are you effing kidding me?
For those who want an up-close look at the bull's balls, I'm sorry, you're going to have to defer
to
another day.
Give me a break here. Unbelievable. Amid arrest, that senior officer was photographed applying pepper spray in a video that is being held up as evidence of a human rights violation, worthy of a trial at the International Criminal Court. It is conceivable that he could have kept his spray holstered. Then again, he was surrounded by chaos. No, in fact... He was not surrounded by chaos because there was a huge orange netting between him and all the protesters. And by all the protesters, I mean those half dozen women that were corralled. The right to free speech comes with responsibilities. It does not encompass a right to do just whatever you want, whenever you want, as these juveniles may one day learn. Now, Glenn Greenwald has a great piece on what's behind the scorn for these protests. He said, it's the nature of protests that take place outside of approved channels, an inevitable byproduct of disruptive dissent. Those who are most vested in safeguarding and legitimizing establishment prerogatives, which by definition includes establishment media outlets, are going to be hostile to those challenges. As the virtually universal disdain in these same circles for WikiLeaks, and before that, the Iraq war protest demonstrated, the more effectively adversarial it is, the more establishment hostility it's going to provoke. Most of the scornful criticism have come from Democratic partisans who, like the politicians to whom they devote their fealty, feign populist opposition to Wall Street political gain. A significant aspect of this progressive disdain is grounded in the belief that the only valid form of political activism is support for Democratic Party candidates and a corresponding desire to undermine anything that distracts from that goal. Indeed, the loyalists of both parties have an interest in marginalizing anything that might serve as a vehicle for activism outside the fealty to one of two parties. I can tell you, the best instrument, in my estimation, to get the Democratic Party to do anything, or I should say one of, I think there's value in taking over local Democratic Party apparatus. But I also think protests like this are extraordinarily helpful. The very idea that one can effectively battle Wall Street's corruption and control by working for the Democratic Party is absurd on its face. And I think that's a fairly valid point. I'm not sure it's mutually exclusive, but certainly if you exclusively work on behalf of the Democratic Party as the only means in which to deal with the corruption that emanates from Wall Street, I think you're going to be out of luck. Much of this progressive criticism consists of relatively, ostensibly well-intentioned, tactical and organizational critiques of the protest. There wasn't a clear, unified message. It lacked a coherent media strategy. The neo-hippie participants were too off-putting to middle America. The resulting police brutality overwhelmed the message, etc., etc. That's the high-minded form from which most progressive scorn for the protests took. It's just not professionally organized or effective. Some of these critiques are ludicrous. Does anyone really not know what the basic message of the protest? I think it's fairly self-evident. Again, it's called Occupy Wall Street, not Occupy Central Park, not Occupy the Natural Museum of History, not Occupy Union Station. I guess, which would be in D.C. or Worcester, Massachusetts. Dismissing these incipient protests because they lack a fully developed, sophisticated professionalization is akin to pronouncing a three-year-old child worthless because he can't read Schopenhauer. I even think that analogy is wrong. I actually think there is value in just the fact that they are exemplifying that there is anger. Anger that is so deep that people are willing to put their physical well-being in peril. Sleeping out on the streets. Risking pepper spray. Or dislocated shoulders. Or a beating from a cop. Or getting arrested. Or quitting their jobs. Or cutting back on their freelance work. What that shows and what the message is that there is commitment to the anger. And the idea that they are not professionally organized should be, in fact, a value added, as the corporatists would say, to their protests. They are not funded by the Koch brothers, the AFP. They're not funded by these large institutional organizations. In fact, it's only today. And last night, some of the protesters went and joined a protest by the postal workers. We've talked about what's going on with the post office on this program in the past. But I believe today there is now local union support that's showing up and perhaps some national unions showing up. They are drawing people to them, despite the fact that they don't have a sophisticated, although it is certainly becoming more sophisticated, media center that is feeding stories to the media. Welcome to the program, Avi.
The police were so insistent that Wall Street not be actually occupied, that they themselves have occupied Wall Street, but to the point that, like, all the business guys can't, like, are, like, hurtling over barricades, and like there's the actual occupation of Wall Street by the police, and it's pretty hilarious to see. Like they're just so terrified of people marching on Wall Street.
That's fantastic. So you're saying that the people who are actually trying to get to their businesses can barely get there through the sea of cops that are down there?
Yeah, and they have physical barricades all over the place, so it's really hard to just get around down there. It's like such overkill. They even shut down one of the subway stops. Like, I mean, I'm skeptical as to what their motivations were for doing all that, but it is actually occupied.
The press coverage of Occupy Wall Street has been pretty abysmal. It's starting to pick up a little bit, and over the weekend, I haven't seen any reports of the numbers, but there was a big march from Wall Street up to Union Square, which is, what, that's got to be like about
30 blocks.
30 blocks. And there were at least a couple of thousand people, I think. I mean, from the videos I've seen. But 80 people were arrested. And the cops are using these sort of this netting. It sort of looks like orange, fairly innocuous netting. And what happens is they use it as if they're using almost like a mobile gate to keep protesters from staying on the sidewalk as opposed to walking into the street. And then at one point, they decide to sort of corral these people just by moving. And it happens pretty quick. I mean, they use this during the RNC protest in 2004, and it happens pretty quick. You don't really realize what's going on. And certainly during the RNC protest, they snared people who had nothing even to do with the protests. And in this one instance, they closed in the gates around not that many people, 20 people maybe, and there were three or four women who were there, I guess, sort of looking past the barricade, yelling about a guy who was being arrested with some force. And a supervising cop, you can tell they're supervisors because they wear a white shirt as opposed to a blue shirt, just walked up. He was probably 5 or 10 feet away from these three or four women. They, I think one was holding a camera. They weren't even close to the orange mesh fence. They were about 3 or 4 feet away from that. He walks up and just sort of randomly decides, it seems, to spray them in their eyes with this mace, and they are writhing in pain on the ground, screaming. The police department issued a statement. The chief spokesman, Paul J. Brown, said the police had used the pepper spray appropriately. Pepper spray was used once, he added, after individuals confronted officers and tried to prevent them from deploying a mesh barrier. There's absolutely no way to watch this video, and the video that we have, I guess, was posted on Atlantic, but it's a YouTube. It's in slow-mo. It details exactly what happened. There's absolutely no way that you can look at this video and in any way assume that these women were trying to prevent them from deploying a mesh barrier. I don't even think these women realized they were being corralled. And then he went on to say something that was edited out or otherwise not captured in the video. You can see there is no moment where you lose sight of what's going on there, particularly in the moments before they're sprayed. So this guy needs to be identified, and there needs to be some disciplinary action taken against this this cop.
The crazy moon of a Wall Street brings a tear to my eye. Mama, why these American girls, they gotta fuss and cry. When they march and get out of line, raise their hand. A man's gotta do what a man's gotta do and bust out his mortar dell. Shut up with your First Amendment or it's no more Mr. Nicey. I sprinkle on the pepper cause I like my dishes spicy. We're the NY Bungalapiti. If you wanna know who we are, this baloney has a last name. It's M-A-C-E-R. We'd hate to see you hurt yourself, so before you lose control, we'll roll you up in a plastic net and we make a nice brujole. Ah. Now, everyone's mad and they got a big vendetta. They call me a pig and Officer Pancetta. I gave these ladies the business back in 2004. Mama, don't nobody respect the law no more. I took a vow to protect and serve your stunati sons and daughters. Don't they understand I'm just maintaining law and order? You're stealing my heart, I spray at the mace. A handy device to shut up in your face. Till you little heartbreakers learn your place. What are you gonna do, make a federal case? With the NY Bungalow PD, if you wanna know who we are, this baloney has a last name, it's M-A-C-E-R. We'd hate to see you hurt yourself, so before you lose control, we'll roll you up in a plastic net and we make a nice patrol. Hey!
Last night, the march sort of broke up. It streamed out of City Hall and made their way through downtown New York, went up Broadway, in and out of traffic, stopping traffic for about 25, 30 blocks. And this was probably the one of the most amazing moments of it. And this is the narration from one of these guys from The Other 99. Let's play this. This is one of the most interesting moments of the evening.
As I'm doing this, I'm hearing screaming. They've taken the net. The protesters have pulled the net away from the police. The police are falling. The net has been claimed by the protesters. Tonight belongs to Occupy Wall Street. I want to say that one more time for everybody. Breaking news. The protesters have taken the orange net from the police and are holding it above their heads in triumph. I saw a few police stumble. What you're seeing right now is them holding the orange net. This is amazing. They're carrying the net over cars. This is the famous kettling net that was used on the Brooklyn Bridge protest.
So basically what it was is the cops had brought out the kettling net. This is the what you saw in that famous video of the Tony Baloney, and we'll give an update on Tony Baloney. How do you spell his name now? STATENISLAND. But this was the net that those women were trapped in when he sprayed them with pepper spray, and or not that specific one, I don't think. And the protesters just essentially grabbed it from the police and just ran up Broadway with it. All right, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. That is sound that Matt took from Friday. As people march to One Police Plaza in New York City, we are the 99%, and one of those 99%ers is on the phone with us now. Jeff, just down from his media perch overlooking Zuccotti Park, or now known as Liberty Square by the occupiers of Wall Street. Jeff, welcome to the program. You sent me a great email giving me an update of what you'd seen since Friday, and I figured, you know what, why read it when I can have you talk about it? Why don't you start with Friday? There was a rumor that Radiohead was going to be playing in the park. Turned out to be not the case, but what happened around that time?
Well, we had obviously a huge influx of people. A lot of them were here for Radiohead, and what we've seen in a lot of cases, when people just show up here for media celebrities or something other than the protest, we always end up peeling off, you know, a certain percentage, and they become part of this movement as well. And so by 5 o'clock, when it was evident that there was no concert to be had here, everyone was ready to go on a scheduled march, and it ended up with sizably larger numbers, and they walked down to One Police Plaza. As a precaution, they decided to make it a silent march just because there were so many new people that had joined, and they didn't want the police to have an excuse to perpetrate any violence on them. And if you noticed, it ended up on the front page of the New York Times on Saturday morning. So
yeah, quite huge. I mean, how many thousands of people were there on Friday?
I mean, at its largest, the park was really pushing capacity. I'd say upwards of 10,000 people. And the march itself down towards One Police Plaza was probably 3,000, 4,000, maybe even 5,000 people. It was enormous.
Yeah, we just played some sound from it. I mean, it's stunning sound. So, and then that night, people came back from the plaza to have a general assembly, and this was amazing. You had close to 1,500 people there. And what happened with the people's mic? That's, I mean, a reminder for people: there's no amplification allowed in the park, and so people use this people's mic. One person says a phrase, it's repeated by the people around them. How did that work out?
Well, what happened was we actually had to install people as repeaters various spots throughout the crowd so that it could kind of reverberate from one group to the next to the next. So the speakers would have to wait, honestly, for it to be repeated 3, 4, 5 times. And it was almost like an aural wave that you could hear kind of wash across this huge crowd. It was pretty cool.
Wow. And just, you know, give us a sense of what type of things are discussed at the General Assembly. I know we've talked about this before, but for our new listeners, people who are just tuning into what's going on with this, what is discussed at the General Assembly?
Well, there are really two types of things, I suppose. One is more about logistics in terms of scheduling meetings and talking about upcoming events or dealing with security or blankets or things of that nature. And the other is really more a political process and the different working groups, particularly the ones that are trying to craft messages, whether it's for creating outreach stations to draw more people in or direct action and actually planning out some of the protests. Even a group has popped up now that's specifically about political reform. And what they do is they work on their own in these subcommittees, and then they bring it to the General Assembly, and they sort of offer it up to the general group. So
So there's now a group, there's now a subgroup that is actually talking about reforming the political process at Liberty Plaza.
That's correct.
Wow. Okay.
And it's really interesting because there's a member of the legal team here I spoke to. Her name is Marissa Citron. She was actually on Democracy Now! And she wrote a book about the movement in Argentina that really started about 10 years ago and talked about how similar really the structure of what's going on at the General Assembly is to them. And her book, you know, talks about horizontal, it's a horizontalidad or whatever the Argentinian word is, but it's about a horizontal structure as opposed to a vertical structure. And what we're seeing now is that with all the satellite movements popping up around the country, I could very easily see this turn into a way where we create almost a parallel political process and organization instead of, you know, trying to be co-opted into the current system. So if we could really organize the people in a way that is on a local level and then comes to a general consensus overall, that becomes a real force and a real power. And so I think as a process, this whole movement is feeling like it's starting to take a shape. And even a week ago, I think I didn't know where this was going or what was going to happen. But it's really starting to get interesting.
It's fascinating because there are over 100 of Facebook groups of Occupy Chicago, Boston, Wall Street, local towns, and several hundred thousand people have already signed up and liked themselves and you know, and have sort of tuned into this. So this is growing both at an accelerated pace and at an accelerated sort of scope. But let's get back to what you experienced on Saturday, because you were one of those guys on the bridge. Who were
yeah,
sort
they,
of
they call us the frontline reporters, by the way.
Yes,
guys that are actually out there.
So you're out there, you're on the front line. Tell me what happened with the Brooklyn Bridge March.
Well, there have definitely been varying accounts in the media, and we know what the police story is, and we know what the New York Times and the traditional media are saying, and then you also hear what people in the protests are saying. But what, you know, what I'm going to tell you is what actually happened from my personal vantage point, and I was pretty much at the front of the group as we were led onto the bridge. And as I said, the entire march was pretty well controlled by the police. They kept us on the sidewalk the entire time down towards Brooklyn Bridge, which was the plan from the onset to cross over the bridge, so it was not as if we were shuttled there or made to go there against our will. We wanted to do that, but as far as the decision to take the roadway as opposed to the pedestrian pathway, the police absolutely stopped the traffic for us and opened the roadway to invite us in. And they walked with us as we went in. And they've claimed that they told us that you do not enter the roadway, you can't go there. But there was really none of that. And they absolutely physically walked with us. We followed them into the roadway. And then at one point, they sort of just pinched off a large group of people on the back end and ended up trapping us up there on the bridge.
Now we should say that the initial group that you're talking about was about 4,000 people strong, correct?
Correct. So, you know, I would say 2,000 of them went, you know, to the right or went to the left and went onto the pedestrian walkway. You know, another couple thousand were sort of going to the right. I would think, from what I've seen and reviewing some of the videos, they didn't really let even the entire march go onto the bridge. They really just wanted to grab a good chunk of people, so to speak. So I'd probably say it was maybe 1,000 people that they trapped up there, and then everyone else kind of circled around on the pedestrian walkway. But it was pretty scary, actually, there for a while. They, you know, as you know, they like to kettle the group. And so when we reached sort of a narrow part of the bridge, they came in with the nets, and they had barricades on both sides and started pushing us in from both sides. And it definitely felt like a situation where people could get trampled. There were people climbing up the bridge itself, trying to get up onto the pedestrian walkway, which is about 15 feet above. Really scary kind of stuff. And so it was fortunate that it didn't escalate into total chaos. But at the same time, I had the feeling that they can't possibly arrest all these people. It's not going to happen. And I think I was basically wrong. They definitely did let some people out. I think maybe I had a better sense of what was about to happen than other people did. And so I was able to kind of make my way out of the arrest circle and circle back around and watch the rest of it from above. But they did, in fact, arrest over 700 people, and it took about 5-6 hours, and I think it's the largest mass arrest in this country since the NYPD in 2004 arrested 1,100 people. So they didn't break their own record, but now they're up there multiple spots on the all-time.
It's stunning. There's a video that we will post on our site of the beginning of the arrest, and the cops clearly didn't know what to do. And then at one point they just said, "Let's just take them one at a time." And then, and you mentioned in your email to me that you saw, you didn't see how the cops, the white-shirted cop's hat ended up flying through the air, but you saw the hat flying through the air. The video is quite clearly a guy reaches out, grabs the cop's hat, and throws it like a frisbee because they had just started to arrest people just as they – and when the crowd understood that they were starting to arrest people, they decided we're all just going to sit down, which is a function, I think, of some civil protest training. Let me ask you this. Is there a sense that this was completely willy-nilly or that – there was some anticipation of the cops? I mean, on first blush, my feeling is the cops who were leading the parade didn't realize, essentially, the protest march, didn't realize that they shouldn't have them go on the street. And then they realized that they couldn't do anything about it, so they arrested them. But on second thought, I'm thinking, you know, with all the video cameras there, this is a good way to catalog all the people who might be at the front of this protest, so that we can get them all into the system and find out who they are.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, I think they definitely may have felt that we can't arrest everyone, but we want to get as many as we possibly can. And the message is clear, I think, because it's similar to what happened a week ago in Union Square. It's almost a tactic where the cops say, you know, you can't walk here, walk over this way, and then when you walk that way, they say you're arrested anyway. And it creates a sort of fear and intimidation that you can't even walk the public streets without the police somehow being able to arrest you for no reason. So I think the tactic is clear, and I imagine that there'll still be more of it coming. One of the really cool things that I started to see is that there's a lot of college-age kids and people just post-college that have been sleeping here, but now I'm starting to see high school kids, and actually there were even some arrests of 13, 14-year-olds on the bridge on Saturday. And it's really incredible. And there was actually one kid who I saw, and I wouldn't have believed this if I didn't see it with my own eyes. He was maybe 9 years old, and he was writing out a sign that his parents weren't telling him what it was, and I jotted it down because I thought, how incredibly astute from a 9-year-old. And he first wrote, "Stop the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya," which... alone, you know, I'm not sure Wolf Blitzer knows that we're at war in Libya.
Right.
And the nine-year-old kid knew it. And then he said, "Stop the bankers from making our politicians take away our health care and education."
Wow.
And I thought, wow, if a 9-year-old kid gets it, we really have something that's brewing in this country. And so it's really impressive. And another thing about the satellite units there, I've seen people here now from the Occupy Boston, and they're coming here to sort of learn what we've learned and pick up tips and share it with their groups and sort of spread it in that way. And from what I've seen, actually, this is really the harshest treatment and the most difficult of the protests. So apparently the Boston cops are much nicer. They're able to put up tents. And in L.A., they have tents. You know, in L.A., it's inclement weather if it's cloudy outside, and,
right,
and they've got the tents up. So, you know, it's really impressive the way it's growing, and I think that this is really starting to turn into something that was much more than I think anyone ever imagined.
All right, one more practical question for you. I know on Wednesday there are a bunch of unions who are slated to come down and support what's going on down there. A lot of local unions. Right now I'm looking at New York Communities for Change, which, of course, is an activist group, but United Federation of Teachers,
local 32BGA, SEIU, 1199 SEIU, Workers United, the Transport Workers Union Local 100, who were really pissed that the cops made them drive around these people who were arrested in their buses, because they're saying our job is to provide public transport, not to be rolling holding cells. Working Family Parties is hoping to help bring people down there, move on. Okay, I saw the pictures of what happened when there were 10,000 people in that park. It was filled to the gill. Like, you could barely walk. What happens if there's 15,000 people?
It's a great question. And actually, the numbers that I'm hearing for this union presence is that it might be more on the order of between 50 and 100,000 people out here.
Wow.
The transit workers alone are saying that they're going to have between 5 and 10,000 people out here. So, I don't know. I mean, it was, even with the crowd that we had on Saturday marching towards the bridge, it was almost too big to orderly communicate and get it going, even though it ended up proceeding in an orderly and calm fashion. But I don't know. I mean, I certainly think it's going to make it harder for the cops to try and arrest every single person anymore. And, you know, I think we're looking forward to it. I mean, you're watching or hearing about history that's really happening in this country.
Jeff, thanks so much for another update. We're going to keep coming back to you if it's all right with you over the course of the week. I really appreciate what you're doing, and I can't thank you enough for keeping us up to speed.
You got it, Sam.
And we'll see you on Thursday. And I don't know, I got to get a majority report shirt or something like that made so that you can be flying your colors.
I was going to say, or even maybe a press pass of some time would actually make me feel a little bit safer, to be honest with you, because I've also started to see that they're cracking down on journalists in a way that's almost insane. I talked to a Mother Jones reporter who, you know, was visibly shaken because the cop told him, put away your pad and that microphone or I'm going to arrest you.
Wow.
And he just couldn't even believe it.
You know, we have seen the way that this has gone, and now, fortunately, the left and institutions are supporting these people and joining them. It was the most ridiculous. I mean, the idea that anybody on the left would be sitting here poo-pooing, I don't like their lack of demand. As far as I'm concerned, as far as demands, and they have come out, Occupy Wall Street released at least a statement, a declaration of the occupation of New York City, and I believe this is by the people from down there. They mention over a dozen aspects of what corporations are doing and what's happening in society that's problematic, all of which I agree what the banks are doing. They've taken our houses through an illegal foreclosure process. In fact, I would go even farther. Despite not having the original mortgage, that's a reference to the lack of chain of title and the robo-signers. But we are still seeing this fraud perpetrated by mortgage services as we speak. They have taken bailouts from taxpayers with impunity and continue to give executives exorbitant bonuses. They have perpetuated inequality and discrimination in the workplace based on age, color of one's skin, gender, sexual identity, and sexual orientation. They have poisoned the food supply through negligence. That story of Cargill the other day. They have profited off the torture and confinement of cruel treatment of countless non-human animals. Talking about factory farming, which breeds things like E. coli and whatnot. And creates these super strain of bacteria that are completely resistant to antibiotics. They've held students hostages with tens of thousands of dollars in debt and education. They've sought to strip employees of the right to negotiate or better pay and safer working conditions. This is an attack on the unions. Outsource labor and uses leverage to cut workers' health care and pay. Influence the court to have the same rights as people with none of the culpability or responsibility. Millions of dollars on legal terms that look for ways to get them out of contracts in regard to health insurance. Sold our privacy as a commodity. Have used military and police to prevent freedom of the press. They have deliberately declined to recall faulty products, endangering the lives in pursuit of profit. It goes on and on and on. And they say, we, the New York City General Assembly, occupying Wall Street and Liberty Square, urge you to assert your power. This is speaking to the people of America. Exercise your right to peaceably assemble. Occupy public space. Create a process to address the problems we face and generate solutions accessible to everyone. To all communities that take action and form in groups in the spirit of direct democracy, we offer support, documentation, and all of the resources at our disposal. Join us and make your voices heard. As far as there are cries for these people who are occupying Wall Street to come out with a specific set of demands, I say, don't do it ever. There isn't a single person in this country who has any awareness or to whom demands would mean anything that doesn't know why you're not there and why you're there. They all know. All they need to see is that you're occupying Wall Street. There is no one who demands would make sense to who don't know why you're there. It's because homes are being foreclosed upon at a record pace, because banks are refusing to refinance loans. It is because of crushing debt. It's because of joblessness and austerity programs that are being pushed. Everyone knows why you're there. And the media elite, whether on the left or the right or the center right or the center left, can say, these people are just howling at the moon. Where are they going to get a howling at the moon? More and more people will join them. More and more people will continue to howl at the moon. And at one point, that noise will be so loud that the elite and the establishment in this country will have to do something just to get them to stop howling. Because the noise will become so great that they will have to do something to get them to stop howling. And the first thing they'll do is they'll try and throw a rock out there. And when they realize it's just too many people howling at the moon, to get them to stop with one rock or two rocks or three rocks, society will have to respond to the problems that have driven people down there and driven people to sleep outside. So as far as I'm concerned, there should never be any demands. Let the establishment, let the elite figure out what's going to satisfy you. Don't give them demands so they can shoot it down or undercut them or co-opt them. Make the establishment deliver real change. And the only way to do it is for them, make them to figure out what it's going to take. There weren't people, mass movements in this country, sleeping outside saying, we need Social Security. They were just saying, we're poor and we're dying on the streets. And you better figure out something that's going to keep us from doing that. Otherwise, there's going to be a bigger problem. Then it's not just going to be our problem, it's going to be your problem. And that's what's happening right now.
Mike Jack!
As you know, the Republican debate took place last night in Las Vegas. And our favorite new CNN host, Erin Burnett, who her journalistic credentials seem to be a strong capacity for eye-rolling, was interviewing, I guess her show came on right before the debate, so she was interviewing people about the debate. And she was in Vegas. And remember now, Occupy Wall Street, TARP, what are you complaining about? We made money on TARP. Sort of purposely or just through her ignorance, didn't realize of the many other ways we have bailed out the investment banks, not the least of which is happening right now, where Bank of America is moving some of their troubled assets into a subsidiary that is covered by the FDIC. The FDIC is very pissed about it. The Fed said it was okay. There's going to be more about this. You'll hear more about it. I'll talk about it in the future. But essentially, it has the effect, again, of saying, taxpayers, you're going to backstop our crap. But aside from that, here's Erin Burnett getting completely drowned out. And it happened for the entire 10-minute segment. We only have like a minute and a half of it or so. But watch how Erin Burnett still is on her jihad to make the Occupy Wall Street people seem disjointed and without focus, because despite the fact that they're cheering one thing over and over again. She says, oh, they're here for so many different things. One can barely keep. And you got to take a look at this video. We'll put it on the site. Her exasperation, and she loses. It completely throws her off her game. Let's play it.
Countdown clock that we'll put up, and you also can probably hear the protesters. They have been various people protesting. These people are singing, banks got bailed out, we got sold out.
Like, we need her to tell us what they're saying. You know what we need? We need the protesters telling us what she's saying. We can hear them. We can't hear you. And here's where she goes on to talk about, oh, they're here for so many different crazy reasons.
There have been other protest groups here today protesting immigration, protesting gay rights, protesting a variety of issues. These obviously are, there's racism protesting, and this obviously is protesting about the banks and taxation. Well, let's bring in Wolf Blitzer, anchor of CNN's Situation Room, John Avlon, CNN contributor and columnist for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, and Gloria Borger, CNN chief political analyst. All right, good to see all of you.
Nice to see you.
And we're seeing the American system in full swing on all sides.
Occupy Las Vegas, that's what they're doing.
That's
here.
Right.
They're protesting, which is their right.
That's right, it absolutely is. And it's nice to see all the different things that they're talking about here.
All right, there she goes. Oh, they absolutely do have that right. And it's nice to see that you're talking about so many different disparate things. I still stand by it. There will be an Occupy Wall Street long after people have forgotten about whatever Aaron Burnett's show's name is. Alyssa, you calling from Oakland. Welcome to the program, Alyssa.
Oh, thank you. I'm calling from Oakland. It was crazy there.
I understand. Were you down there in the, were you in the park Tuesday night, Tuesday morning?
Yeah, I was in the first group that got arrested. I may have been the first person that got arrested. I'm not sure.
Oh, well, hold on for a second. That deserves a... That deserves a fanfare. Wow. Are you saying that the police, they gave you a warning, they said clear the park or you'll be arrested, and before they even attempted to arrest people, they started lobbing tear gas?
Yeah, they didn't even ask us, because, you know, to go willingly. They just threw tear gas in. Yeah. They didn't say, would you come? Nothing like that. They came, they wanted to just storm the camp, basically. Like, as if we were at war and they were, you know, terrorizing a village. But, you know, it was just really bad. I was surprised at the extent of brutality that showed. Unnecessary. A police officer grabbed me from behind. I had my bag because I have multiple sclerosis, so I had my medicine and even my ID, everything was in my bag, but he just threw it, you know, and grabbed me forcefully, and I was like, I need my bag, you know, I have MS, my medicine's in it. He was like, too bad, you know, and I kept on saying I needed it, and it was only because of that another police officer gave it to me. He wasn't going to. For the people that were still in tents, they were literally kicking them like they were playing soccer. Like, just kicking the people, you know, the tents with people in them, like, you know, two police officers. It's just terrible.
I heard reports that they were putting restrictions on people in terms of them returning to the park. Did they say what was going to happen to you? Did they say don't go back to the park? What did they say?
Right. They told me that if they see me in the park, they because I have a court date December 5th. And the $10,000 bail, but I guess they waived that for now. They said if they see me there again, they'll hold me to December 5th, plus like double or triple the bail that I would have to pay in order to get out before then.
Your story is really inspirational. And it's really...
I went back yesterday, too.
You did? Tell us about that.
Yeah.
What did you see when you went back?
Oh, when I went back, we marched, oh, it was like there were so many people because we're going to keep meeting. We marched down back through back by the plaza to the police station. I saw the police take bully their clubs and start beating up a couple. Like, they pulled some of us, like three people or two people, out of the group and just started like hitting them with the billy club and like slamming them down. And then the crowd was like standing around saying shame. I thought there was a whole bunch. But then we divided. Then we kept marching. Then I saw like just people being tear gassed, and people told me that they were that they saw the rubber bullets and stuff. I didn't want to get arrested again, so I wasn't up front this time. Like, part of me wanted to, but I was like, I'm just too tired. I need to rest. So I kind of stayed in the back, but I wanted to be there, like, as much as I could.
Well, Alyssa, again, you know, it's such an inspirational story. It's, you know, so much bravery that you're showing, and I really appreciate you sharing your story with us. Is there anything else you wanted to let us know?
No, just that, like, I hope people don't let the media, like, give them, like, I hope that they understand that these are good kids. Even if you see a couple of them acting up, just think of going to a college dorm or something. You know, it's pretty age appropriate. For the most part, they are, like, way more politically informed and caring than my generation was. And what they're doing is really inspirational, you know, and I'm really grateful to them and, you know, all the other people.
We've got a statement from the Oakland mayor, Gene Kwan. Over the last week, it was apparent that neither the demonstrators nor the city could maintain safe or sanitary conditions or control the ongoing vandalism at Frank Ogawa Plaza. Frank Ogawa Plaza will continue to be open as a free speech area from the hours of 6 a.m. to 10 p.m.
I forgot that part of the First Amendment where we need to be designated free speech
areas. Free's got an asterisk next to it.
And there's hours of operation for free speech, too.
That's right.
Do I have to wear shoes and shirt, too, while I'm
My understanding, and according to a protester, is that Frank Ogawa Plaza was full of rats days before the protest was there, weeks before the protest. They only started caring about it when there were protesters there.
It's Oakland.
If it's not the murder capital of the country, it's pretty darn close on a per capita basis. So there's no indication that there was any more violence or sanitary problems in that park because of the protesters than there were beforehand. She went on to say, I commend Chief Jordan for generally peaceful resolution. A recent poll has come out that Sunday morning news shows do the most to help people learn about current events, while some outlets, especially Fox News, lead people to be even less informed than those who don't watch any news at all. In other words, not only does Fox News not give you the whole story, they make you stupider. People who watch Fox News, the most popular 24-hour cable networks, are 18 points less likely to know that Egyptians overthrew their government than those who watch no news at all. And that's after controlling for other news sources, partisanship, education, and other demographic factors. In other words, watching Fox News makes you stupider. Fairleigh Dickinson, political science reporter Dan Cassino, stresses that it's not a function of being Republican, because Republicans in general were not uninformed about current events. But Fox viewers, the results show us there is something about watching Fox News that leads people to do worse on these questions than those who don't watch any news at all. And here is a prime example. Brought to you in the forum of Megyn Kelly and Bill O'Reilly.
Say, baby, put down that pipe and get my pipe up.
And here it is now.
First of all, pepper spray. That just burns your eyes, right?
Right. I mean, it's like a derivative of actual pepper. It's a food product, essentially.
You know what else is essentially a food product? Cyanide. It's in your peach pits. It's essentially a food product. It's like, you know, some people throw salt over their shoulder. You know what else is pepper spray? It's also known by another name, mace. It just so happens that mace is a brand of pepper spray. But we ended up calling it mace. But when it's the pepper spray, it's just a little pepper. It's a little bit. This may be a little spicy right in your eyes. And yes. It's considered a less than lethal agent, but it is deadly in some rare cases. But it's essentially a food product.
But a lot of experts are looking at that and saying, is that the real deal? Has it been diluted because
Yeah, that should they should have more of a reaction.
Yeah,
than
but
that.
That's really beside the point. I mean, it was something that was obviously abrasive and intrusive. And
in other words, what Bill O'Reilly's saying, like, just having to like wash out your eyes and scream in pain, that's not of a reaction. I want to see skin peeling off the bones.
I want to see faces melting like candles.
Yeah, if we don't see faces melting like candles, that's not that's a food product.
Seven,
and they wanted them.
Several to, went to the hospital.
Right, they just wanted them to get out of there, stop blocking what they were blocking.
Yes.
They wanted to scatter them.
This was on the chancellor's orders. The chancellor ordered the police to go in and force.
You understand that the chancellor ordered this. The chancellor. So when the chancellor says that people must be moving, you don't. When the chancellor says to leave, you leave. Otherwise, you get sprayed with the food product that makes your face melt. Please continue.
Force these students to disperse.
That's
and
Linda Catali or
yes,
Kate.
And it is a crime. They were charged. 10 of them were charged with unlawful assembly and failure to disperse because they were posing a sit-in, a student protest. And you can do that. That's very American.
They were posing a sit-in. You realize that they were posing a sit-in, sort of like a threat, like posing a threat. But in this case, it was a sit-in. We don't sit here. They get pepper sprayed.
But it may also happen to break the law.
They wanted to get these people off the campus, and they didn't want to lay hands on them.
Right.
See, there's two ways to do this. You can do the pepper spray, or that, you know, you can physically drag them out of there.
They then did lay hands on them.
I know, but you don't want to lay hands on
someone. No, but what I'm saying is the police would respond by saying,
I love how O'Reilly is suddenly a crowd control expert. You don't want to lay hands on them. What you want to do is you want to spray the pepper spray. Then you want to take in the gun that will actually surround them in a force field. And then lift them with the force field into the paddy wagon. You don't want to touch them. Well, they did touch them. Keep going.
You pepper spray first to allow the hands-on part to be less confrontational because you're going to get less resistance when you got somebody who just got pepper sprayed.
Yeah.
Listen, I know the tape looks bad. I agree it looks bad. All I'm saying is that from a legal standpoint, I don't know that the cops did anything wrong. We're going to have to learn more about the facts. But the cops are allowed to use reasonable force to affect compliance with an arrest.
Yep.
It does look like these students were failing to disperse and were, in some cases, unlawfully assembling and perhaps even resisting arrest. Here, there are some, you didn't show it on the tape, but where the cop goes to grab one of the students and you can see she puts her arm back. She's not letting him grab her.
You saw that the woman, when the cop grabbed her, she attempted in some way, to put her hand away. At that point, the chancellor has said, you must leave now. You must leave now. Leave the sidewalk. You are blocking the sidewalk. You're opposing a city. So it is time for you to leave. Chancellor has said it. The chancellor has said it.
It looks like these cops have room to argue that this was not excessive force. Does that mean they should have affected the arrests in this way? That's a moral discussion.
Yeah, I don't think we have the right to Monday morning quarterback the police, and particularly at a place like UC Davis, which is, you know, a fairly liberal campus, and they're not, you know, running around.
You understand that in America, we don't have the right to look back on the police and question what they do, particularly if it's a liberal campus and they're running around. The chancellor said you must move, and they did not move. The chancellor said it. Please bring out the water cannons. Water is just, it's the essence of life, water. With a water cannon, it's even that much more essence of life. We all have iron in our blood. So when you club someone with a tire iron, what are you doing? Unbelievable. And I just can't understand why people become more stupid when they watch Fox News. On the phone, we have Jeff Smith, who is... Jeff, where are you now?
I am down just outside of Zuccotti Park.
All right.
The police are currently occupying the space and not letting anybody get in there right now. But we are actually waiting now. I don't know if you heard. I mean, we can go through the whole story, but there was actually a temporary restraining order that was filed late last night into the morning, and the cops actually denied that restraining order. So they went in essentially into the park illegally to evict us, and now there's another court hearing going on as we speak to basically defend our right to come back into the park, tents and all.
Now, I've got the restraining order now, and... So are you saying that this restraining order happened last night?
Yes, the paperwork was basically filed immediately as the eviction started, and we were able to get a judge to sign off on it within a couple of hours. So we actually had people trying to serve this restraining order to police all over the park as they evicted people last night.
Wow. I didn't realize that was the case. I mean, I'm seeing it... I'm seeing the order, and maybe this is a different order, but I'm seeing the order signed at 6:30 a.m. on 11/15/11 by Lucy Billings. She is a justice of the Supreme Court of the state of New York, out of the county of New York. I guess it's unclear as to what time that that happened. But why don't you walk us through what happened last night? I know that the text message went out at about, I guess the first one came out at about 1:27 or 12:59, Occupy New York, urgent, hundreds of police mobilizing around Zuccotti, eviction in progress. So tell me, were you there last night?
I was. I was coming back from a spokes council meeting that was on off-site, and so as I came back around the park around, I guess, 12:30, I was talking on the phone, just sort of circling the park, walking in and out, and that's when I started to notice that they brought in these enormous light rigs, lighting standards that they erected on every side of the park. It looked like Yankee Stadium out here, and that was pretty much when I realized this is definitely not something normal going on. And they began cordoning off the square, not letting anyone go in or out, and there were hundreds and hundreds of cops in riot gear, this time with actual shields and their batons drawn, and it was clear that something pretty messy was about to go down.
Now, at that time, my understanding is they shut down the subway's stops down to Occupy Wall Street. They had grounded essentially all of the news helicopters, so they're not allowing them to take pictures. So what happened? Did you enter the park at that point? Were you in the park? And then what happened?
I was in the park, and the cops were staging. And basically, once they came into the park, they pretty much came with the baton swinging. They told people to get out of the park, but it was pretty much simultaneously with a raised baton, you know, aimed at your head or your stomach or your knees, and they told you basically, you know, get out of here or, you know, I'm going to beat the crap out of you. And, I took the warning and proceeded, and, you know, I still ended up getting grabbed by the back of the shirt and thrown on the ground and eventually did get out of there. But it was pretty messy, and there were certainly a lot of people that got beaten pretty badly. There were some members of the people that locked themselves into the park, used like bicycle U-locks, and attach themselves to trees and other things to nail themselves down. Huge plumes of pepper spray all over the place as they subdued people. And there was even a city councilman, Adonis Rodriguez, who was in the park, who was beaten pretty severely, cracked over the head. His head was split open with a baton. And although there was clearly a media blackout, and it was one of the more sinister aspects of this raid, was that Bloomberg was able to effectively clear out every form of broadcast media, including the CNN truck that sits next to the park virtually 24 hours a day,
And so there was almost no broadcast coverage, but there were definitely videos inside the park, and people caught a lot of action, and so I think you're going to start to see those emerging throughout the day.
There were reports last night as I was watching the live stream that there was use of the LRAD, the sound cannons. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, that was basically used against the people that were tied in, sort of locked themselves down and refused to get out of the park. And I did see the vehicle. I didn't hear it directly. I was out of the park at the time when they used it. But I did definitely hear confirmation from some people that they used it. And it was quite painful, apparently, to the people in the park.
I would imagine. Now, we have a link on Majority FM to some video that was taken apparently by one of the people who were had chained themselves in the kitchen area. And you can see the police begin to basically come in and begin to tear it down. You could see the video last night of them throwing all of the tents, all of the equipment, all of the books from the library, 5,000 books into dumpsters. Was there much media equipment that was in there? I mean, exactly how much stuff was lost by people?
I think there was quite a bit. I mean, they're claiming that all the stuff is available to be picked up at a sanitation location. So they're claiming they didn't throw it away, but they definitely destroyed most of the tents in the process. And I guess it remains to be seen whether computer equipment and other such devices were damaged. Clearly, there was no real regard for our property rights, much less our First Amendment rights out there.
And so after the park is cleared out, at least of those people who had not chained themselves in the park, where did you go? Where did people go?
Well, I actually went from inside the park across the street to the lot there to continue to watch, and then the police cordoned off that area and forced us out. And basically, they just continue to push people up Broadway away from the location. Just lines of cops would just sweep across blocks and push everyone. And so even the news vans from all the local networks were parked up, you know, 3-4 blocks away from the park, nowhere near where they could get any footage. And eventually people went to Holy Square. And so they met there impromptu, you know, maybe 3-4 a.m. And then others went to a church near NYU, the Judson Church, which has opened their doors to us. And so some of us went there to kind of regroup. But overall, people were definitely their spirits were high. Nobody feels like this is any kind of an end to the occupation, regardless of what happens. And frankly, I think people feel like this is only going to make us stronger again.
Now, are you aware there was a group of protesters, of occupiers, who marched up to, I guess it was Canal and or 6th and Grand or Canal and Grand, somewhere in that area, and they have begun to occupy a fenced-in lot up there. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, it's actually a sort of triangle-shaped lot. It's at Canal and 6th Avenue. And the property is actually privately owned by one of the churches. And so they've opened up the area, and what actually happened there was a press conference where a number of clergy came. There was a priest and a rabbi and a Buddhist monk. And they all made statements essentially in solidarity with the movement. And specifically, they told us about a call they made out citywide to every church, every synagogue, every religious house all throughout this city, to open their doors to the occupiers, open their kitchens, open their bathrooms, their sanctuaries. And so there was definitely a concerted call for help for this movement. And they really saw this as an important moment in trying to reclaim this country and our common space. And really, you know, they brought the sense of justice in a religious sense that I think was really powerful. So I think this puts all the more pressure on
on Mike Bloomberg. And frankly, I think what's happened here is that Mike Bloomberg has become, you know, kind of the most hated man in New York right now.
I'm seeing reports from a woman named Allison Birch, who was there. She writes, in terms of the police claiming they were never served with the restraining order, she writes, and I can't confirm this, but it was retweeted by Alternet as well, I was there. The deputy refused to receive it. It is all on tape. They were served. As it is now in the courtroom, the lawyers for Occupy Wall Street and the ACLU and the National Legal Guild have just gotten a counterfiling from Bloomberg. So now, what are people talking about in terms of tomorrow? There was a lot of action taking planned for the 2-month anniversary of the occupation. Has there been a GA? Has there been any notion of what's going to happen going forward, or are people just waiting essentially to see if they can get back into Zuccotti?
The people have definitely congregated back down here at Zuccotti and are, you know, seeing what's going to happen here. The action you're talking about is actually scheduled for Thursday, I believe.
Oh, Thursday. Sorry, yes.
And yes, I mean, I think it was something that we thought would go off regardless. I mean, we didn't know this eviction was going to happen, but I think now they've only served to make it that much bigger. I imagine that we'll have people even coming in from around the country to help us occupy it, and we have a number of different actions that will all be simultaneous, but it's really about how many people we can mobilize, and I think given what happened last night, I think that the whole world will be watching what happens down on Wall Street on Thursday morning.
All right, and so tell me again, we're gonna talk to Harry Siegel in a minute and get his perspective. But where are you specifically right now, and what are you seeing?
I am on Liberty Street on the side of the park, and there are cops in riot gear basically lining the entire park, standing up on the ledge, straight down one side around the corner and the other side. And then there are also cops all on the inside. So I'd say there's probably a total of 200 cops or so, maybe, total holding the park right now. And there have been a couple of arrests that have happened just out on the perimeter of the park. But I think people are waiting to see sort of what happens here. It doesn't feel like it's really a police showdown, but I think people feel like we've been at least vindicated on some level in the courts. And, I think we always felt like we were in the right in terms of our right to occupy this space. So I think the further that the city, you know, turns this into a police state and tries to keep us from peaceably assembling, I think it's frankly a stain on the city and Mayor Bloomberg right now.
And we should make this absolutely clear. Right now, the hearing is going on to determine whether or not the occupiers can stay in formerly known as Zuccotti Park. But what is absolutely clear and indisputable is that the police are now functioning in a direct contradiction to a court order. As of now, the occupiers should be allowed into the park as per the order of the state Supreme Court. The police are now basically in contempt of that court order. It remains to be seen what the resolution of the hearing is going to be, but they are clearly in violation of that court order right now. And, Jeff, how many protesters would you say are there?
I would say it's probably between 200 and 300 people. I mean, there's also just a lot of traffic amongst people that have come here to support us. And to correct one thing that you said, I believe the temporary restraining order that was issued last night expired at 11:30 a.m., which is when the new trial is scheduled to take place. So I think technically, as of right now, maybe they have the right to keep us out of the park, but only because the mayor has decided to just close the park, as opposed to what he had said earlier, that he just wanted to have the park clean and then we would be able to re-enter it. So
I think clearly the court order has made the mayor have to double back on his word. And you're correct. At this point now, it seems like regardless of what the court order says, it doesn't appear as if the police are going to let us back in the park. And certainly not with tents and sleeping bags as the judgment orders.
Let's play some clips from His Highness, I don't know what you could call this guy, the scofflaw, chief scofflaw of the city, the only one who violated any laws in the past 24 hours. I'm, of course, talking about His Highness, Mayor Bloomberg. King has now entered the press conference hall, adorned in robes, holding a grand scepter, wearing a wonderfully studded crown. His minions are following him to the stage. Advisor Wolfson, the chief of police, they've assembled. They are looking glorious, regal, and magnificent. And now, let us hear what the king has to say.
At 1 o'clock this morning, the New York City Police Department and the owners of Zuccotti Park notified protesters in the park that they had to immediately remove tents, sleeping bags, and other belongings, and must follow the park rules if they wish to continue to use it to protest. Many protesters peacefully complied and left. At Brookfield's request, members of the NYPD and Sanitation Department assisted in removing any remaining tents and sleeping bags. This action was taken at this time of the day to reduce the risk of confrontation in the park and to minimize disruption to the surrounding neighborhood. Protesters were asked to temporarily leave the park while this occurred and were told that they would be free to return to the park once Brookfield finished cleaning. We are now ready to reopen the park.
Why are city sanitation workers working for Brookfield? I don't know. Maybe that's part of the contract. Maybe it isn't. I don't know.
But understand that there is a court order, which we have not yet actually received, enjoining us from enforcing Brookfield's rules, and so the park will remain closed until we can clarify that situation. But I want to stress
that is a lie. It's quite clear what the court ruling stated. Now, Bloomberg was aware of it at 9 a.m. when he was giving this press conference, and still, in violation of that court order, the mayor and the police kept the protesters and continue to keep the protesters from re-entering Zuccotti Park.
That our intention was to reopen the park and to let people go in and express their First Amendment rights to protest or their First Amendment's rights, Amendment rights to just peacefully enjoy the park and say nothing. In the future, protesters and the general public will be welcome there to exercise their First Amendment rights and otherwise enjoy the park, but will not be allowed to use tents, sleeping bags, or tarps, and going forward must follow all park rules.
That is His Highness. Let's play the next clip of his press conference.
We could not wait for someone in the park to get killed or to injure another first responder before acting. Others have cautioned against action because enforcing our laws might be used by some protesters as a pretext for violence. But we must never be afraid to insist on compliance with our laws. Unfortunately, the park was becoming a place where people came not to protest, but rather to break laws and in some cases to harm others. There have been reports of businesses being threatened and complaints about noise and unsanitary conditions that have seriously impacted the quality of life for residents and businesses in this now thriving neighborhood.
First off, the community board, which represents the neighborhood, has supported the occupation. On numerous occasions, they have reiterated their support by vote. So who is he referring to? Epi? The Milk Street Cafe, he said the biggest problem he had was the barricades erected by the police. And for every owner of Milk Street Cafe, there are other merchants who say that their business has skyrocketed.
The majority of protesters have been peaceful and responsible, but an unfortunate minority has not been. And as the number of protesters has grown, this has created an intolerable situation. No right is absolute, and with every right comes responsibility. The First Amendment gives every New Yorker the right to speak out, but it does not give anyone the right to sleep in a park or otherwise take it over.
How does he know this? If we know that money is considered by the Supreme Court to be speech, because it is a mechanism to which speech is formulated and amplified, how do we know that sleeping out in a tent is not also a mechanism in which free speech is amplified? I mean, is there any doubt that without the occupation that we would not have heard these protests? Is there any doubt? Is there anybody who couldn't make that case? Is there anybody who would deny that the implications of this being an occupation as opposed to a one-day protest is that it has gotten far, it has facilitated their speech in a way that, let's say, money does for corporations or for the rich? Michael Bloomberg does not know whether or not that is, let me put it this way. Michael Bloomberg is not in a position to determine whether or not that is valid free speech. That's not his job. That's not his job.
To the exclusion of others.
There was no one excluded from that park. Ever. Ever, ever. In fact, that was one of the difficulties the occupiers faced. No one was excluded from that park.
Nor does it permit anyone in our society to live outside the law. There is no ambiguity in the law here. The First Amendment protects speech. It does not protect the use of tents and sleeping bags to take over a public space.
He just does not know that. He is not qualified to say there's no ambiguity in the First Amendment as to whether or not sleeping outside in tents in public space is a function of free speech. He is not qualified to do that. Among the other things that he seems apparently not to be qualified to do, he is not qualified to make that judgment. It is a tremendous pleasure for me to welcome to the program not a frequent guest, but a semi-frequent, I guess, but always just a cherished guest to the program, Fran Lebowitz. Fran, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
It's been a long time since we spoke, and I want to I want to just get your take. You know, there of literally the hundreds, maybe even thousands of people I've interviewed over the past 7 or 8 years. There are a couple of things that you have told me on the radio that have just resonated with me tremendously. And one of them was that if we were ever going to see any type of change in this country, it's going to have to come from young people and it's going to have to come from culture. Can you elaborate on that? Do you still feel that way?
Yes, I still feel that way. Well, clearly it's not going to come from old people. You know, and clearly it's not going to come from politics. What I meant by culture was actual culture. I know we're not supposed to use that word anymore. I meant actually from artists. You know, I know that we use that word way too much, you know, but because what I believe I was saying to you, and I'm pretty sure this is true because I haven't been able to change what I was saying. I'd love to. But it's just that, you know, we live in this merry-go-round of nostalgia, you know, and that is certainly true of, you know, the culture, if you want to call it that, and it's certainly true of politics. I mean, this is the most retrograde era. You know, it's shocking. You know, at the same time, it's a truly revolutionary era. You think people might want to take advantage of that. But every solution for everything is a backward solution. It should be like it was, even this Occupy Wall Street. I keep hearing from people, this is like the 60s, this is like the 70s, but it's not. And it shouldn't be, you know, because this era is not like that. You know, I mean, there were good things about the old times, you know, but not everything, because it's led to these times.
You know, I'm curious about that notion because, you know, I think like the interesting thing is that much of the way that the mainstream press and even the I've noticed it from the liberal establishment have attempted to attack Occupy Wall Street as being hippies. And I don't think that Occupy Wall Street people perceive themselves that way. And certainly what they're protesting against is not the same genre. I mean, we're not talking about a war and we're not talking about social emancipation. We're talking about economic issues primarily.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that these people want in, not out. You know, that's the primary difference. You know, I mean, the 60s, or whatever you want to call them, which, of course, mostly took place during the 70s and mostly didn't take place at all the way people imagine, was about wanting out, you know, not wanting in. Was, you know, these people want, as far as I could tell, want in, meaning, you know, I'm not hearing any particularly radical notions from any of these people. Maybe they have them, but no one's told me. They're complaining about the present time, which... Who could defend this, by the way? The interesting thing to me is that there's not a real defense of the status quo because it's indefensible. It is totally indefensible. You know, for instance, today, all day long, what I've been thinking about, where is the mayor? Where's the mayor? You know, we don't see hide nor hair of the mayor, you know, who... the thing I've enjoyed most, I have to say, about Occupy Wall Street, because I am a... vengeful and superficial person, is to see Bloomberg not have any idea which way to go with this thing. He does have no idea what to say, what to do. We know that, you know, what he really feels, because, I mean, this mayor is not even in the 1%. He's in the 1% of the 1%. We have a mayor who is so rich that he will not live in a place actually called Gracie Mansion. It's not nice enough for him. You know, and he has not in any way attracted the ire of these people, which is shocking to me. I mean, when I walk around and sometimes these kids talk to me, I say, go to Bloomberg's house. Go, you know, the day they went to people, rich people's houses, I said, go to Bloomberg's house. And this kid said to me, no, he's okay. He said, we could stay. I said, what are you talking about? This is his city. Anyone can stay. This is not his estate. To me, it's absurd. But today, we don't see him at all. In the last few days, we haven't seen him at all. We've seen his proxy, what's his name, Wolfson, and we've seen the new doe-eyed Christine Quinn, all of a sudden champion of the people. You know, not in fact his henchman or henchwoman, as she's been for the last 40 years of his mayoralty, who helped him overturn in two elections in order to have this third term, and we haven't seen him all day long. So to me, you don't have to be young to hate what's going on. You do have to be young to sleep outside, however, that I would have to give.
Yeah, well, I will say I think Mayor Bloomberg, as of whatever it was, 48 hours ago, when he ordered the riot geared police to go and evict the protesters, I suspect now there's not the same warm feelings towards Bloomberg that there were just 3 days ago.
Yeah, but if they were more informed, there never would have been. And right. Not just the Occupy Wall Street. I mean, he is a central villain in all of this. I mean, he is a zillionaire. A zillionaire. And people, you know, basically until this second, it seemed like the American people, all of them, no matter what age they were, had a reference for this. Because I know this, because you constantly hear the word earn before the word billion. And really, no one earns $1 billion. You steal $1 billion. You earn $10 an hour. You know, it's absurd. You know. So I would like to see some ire, you know, in his direction. And I would also, you know, people should notice. I mean, I don't know if they do because they may be preoccupied with, you know, greater ideals. But the response of the city in general is a response having totally to do with jockeying position for the next election, which everyone thinks because they wish was this month, but in fact is 2 years from now. And that is why you see Christine Quinn practically crying, standing next to the city councilman who got arrested. His name I don't know because I never heard of him before. And she was like Bambi next to him. You know, I mean, she is an architect of this. And she's wanting to take it over and continue it. You know, this is about real estate. You know, that's really what it's about. This park, Zuccotti Park, let me assure you, no New Yorker ever heard of it. Did you ever hear of this?
Never.
Now, they keep saying, especially on national news, they keep saying Zuccotti Park, as if everyone, you know, who grew up in New York cavorted in this park as a child. You know, this is some sort of real estate deal. That's why, you know, it's bookmarked in the way that it is. You know, that's why he had to let them in, or, you know, couldn't throw them out, because they made a deal with the city in the 60s, I believe, we can keep this little piece of property for whatever they were hoping to keep it for, which, believe me, was not to allow, you know, the free exchange of ideas, but we have to keep it open, which, by the way, the mayor has closed the parks at midnight. There's curfews in every park in New York City at midnight. He doesn't have a right to do that. They're public parks. That's what public means. If you're crazy enough to want to go in Central Park at 3 in the morning, you have that right. But no one ever protests this. So, of course, people my age, you know, or at least myself, you know, we were delighted to see this, you know, to see the beginning of this. Many people, you know, say, well, what do they want? What do they want? They don't seem to know exactly what they want. Everyone my age says it doesn't matter, because what the thing that I see that is like when I was young is the pandering to people who are young from people my age, which is merely like wanting them to like you, you know, where they want them. So they say, well, we think it's great that they have no agenda. I have actually no opinion as to what, you know, what their agenda is or not their agenda. I unfortunately am not in a position to spend all my time worrying about other people's agenda. I still have my own. So, but I would like to see the mayor. I mean, the mayor, I don't understand where he is.
I imagine he's in a bunker somewhere, watching maybe the live stream on his computer of what's going.
Well, I mean, you know, I hope that, you know, that this has an effect. You know, and if, you know, we live in an environment where, you know, people are so, I can't even think of the word, not even surrounded. We live in an environment that is just basically a media environment, no matter what kind of media it is. And so that's the way that people gauge things. You know, how much play is it getting on this? What are people saying on that? You know, but that really is not the important thing. It seems like the important thing. In fact, it seems like the only thing. You know, but that is not the important thing. And meanwhile, you know, maybe someone could figure out, like, what is Congress doing during this? You know, that's kind of the important thing.
I mean, is that the only important thing? I mean, is it in terms of, like, Congress's reaction to this or?
No, I'm not talking about their reaction to this. I'm talking about, you know, listen, you know, I mean, this Congress, as far as I could tell, is a criminal enterprise, pure and simple. You know, I mean, to me, you know, this is like the three-card Monte games we no longer have in Times Square. You know, they probably, and I say they, you know, because, you know, to me, they're almost, you know, a kind of cohesive body at the Democrats and the Republicans. And, you know, probably while everyone's attention is on this, because this is, you know, the kind of thing people like to cover, this has a certain kind of excitement to it, they're doing something and it's not good.
Right. Well,
whatever they're doing is wrong. This I know. It's like when I was a little kid and, you know, your parents would say, you know, the kids are too quiet.
Right.
You know, they're up to something, you know, and so these people are too quiet. They're up to something and it is not good.
Well, we're just literally less than a week away from when the so-called super committee is going to either make their deadline or not make their deadline to cut essentially Social Security and Medicare, which seems to be that the if there is a deal, the most likely deal to take place out of Congress. And, of course, you know, many people talked about John Kerry being put on there as a way of being the most liberal voice. But it seems like he is going to be out in front in terms of trying to make that deal. And he could very well be the seventh vote that passes it through the super committee.
Yes, that's what it looks like to me. I mean, but, you know, first of all, has anyone mentioned, you know, a super committee? What do they think Congress is supposed to be? This is absurd. This is as if you, like, hire a plumber for your house, and he hires a plumber.
Right.
You know? I mean, you say, did you fix the broken pipe? And he goes, no, I'm waiting for the guy that I hired to fix the broken pipe. You know, I mean, this is just a way of passing the buck.
Yes, and I think that's actually sort of explicitly the point of it. I mean, that's why they're not subject to the filibuster, not subject to any amendments in the House. But I agree with you that what's happening in Congress is really important. But it seems like there has been little ability of the people, whether you want to talk about the mass of people as reflected in what they want, as reflected in polls in terms of protecting things like our social insurance, or even the policy elite, whether you're talking about economists who say this is not the time for austerity, or frankly, real world experience. You look at what's happening in Britain, you look at what's happening in Spain in terms of austerity. There has been nothing that has been able to impact these people. And part of that, I think, is because of the greater influence that money has in our politics. And so what's left at that point?
Yes, well, that's the main thing that's wrong. I mean, we could, when I say we, I mean, you know, Americans, we could take this away. I mean, there's never, listen, let me tell you something. I mean, I am not a person easily shocked, but the thing probably of the last, like, 20 years that most shocked me was the decision of Supreme Court Bush v. Gore. That really shocked me, okay? And there was no outcry about that. You know, if a zillion people had gone to Washington, you know, there would have been some kind of outcry. There would have been some kind of change. You know, people, you can't sit around, you know, for 30 years and expect nothing to happen. You know, expect, you know, nothing bad to happen. You know that from your own life, you know, so that, yes, it's money. It's money. It's not that complicated. It's money. But truly, you know, I mean, I have to say that, you know, when Obama was running for the presidency, I was not a huge champion of Obama. I voted for him. But the reason was I felt I knew he was to the right of me on what were then called domestic economic issues. And I knew that because of the age difference. I mean, I don't know. No, he's like 10 years younger than I am, which, and by the way, it is one of the worst things on the planet to have a president younger than you. and he is just that generation. That's just that 10 years. It could even be 5 years, you know, of people who believe there's such a thing as clean money. You know, clean money is like clean coal. You know, believe in things like public-private partnerships. You know, this is a belief of all people Obama's age or younger, which are most people. You know, now it's most people, and it's certainly most people who, you know, are active in these things. And this is not true. You know, there's no such thing. All these words that companies started using maybe 20 years ago, you know, which I used to say, these are the words of poets. You know, vision. You know, businessmen don't have visions. They don't have vision. It's like when Steve Jobs died, you would have think, I don't know, you know, that Leonardo died. I mean, businesses have one goal, make a profit. That is a perfectly appropriate goal for business. It is an awful goal for anything else. And so when you mix these two things together, for instance, privatize the prison system, yes, what could be worse? The prison system is already a horrible thing that you have to have, and then let's introduce the profit motive. So these things have to be disentangled. Nothing good will happen until they are. Nothing good will happen until people say you cannot mix these two things. No, we don't want private money in the public school system. We want public money in the public school system. You know, when you hear a rich person say they're giving back, you know, here's my advice to them. Don't take to begin with.
When did money become... I mean, I know that money has always been an ascendant value in our society. Maybe it hasn't, but that's my presumption. But it seems to me that at least in my lifetime, there has been no, or at least in my adult lifetime, there has been no counterculture where money is irrelevant. I'm not saying like that has been anti-money, but it seems to me that in American history, we have always had a culture embedded in America. Maybe it was a very small one, maybe it was just urban, but which had values where money was not the ascendant value. Am I right in believing that at the very least up until Occupy Wall Street, maybe even including, but I don't think so, but that there's been an absence of whether you want to call them, artists or communists or bohemians or yippies. There's been no culture that is saying that we have values where we can judge each other distinct from your capacity to make money.
Yes, well, there used to be competing values in the culture. They were not the sole property of bohemians, by the way. My theory about this, I'm so glad you asked because no one ever does. My theory about this, which probably sounds like a crackpot theory, is that you know, I'm not saying this started, but to me, one of the real landmarks of this is when doctors and lawyers started to be allowed to advertise. Oh. Now, you are too young probably to remember when they weren't.
No, oddly enough, I was raised by a pack of lawyers, and it is the one thing I remember. It was like somebody had died in my household on that day.
That's right. Well, doctors and lawyers, and by the way, doctors and lawyers, I'm assuming, especially lawyers, I'm guessing, fought for this, okay? But they weren't allowed to advertise because they were considered to be above commerce. Above, okay? Not below, but above commerce. And that's why they were called the professions, okay, instead of the businessmen. And there was no such thing as a for-profit hospital. It wasn't allowed. You know, it wasn't that doctors, you know, were rich compared to other people. You know, they weren't rich, you know, the way they can become now. No one was, nor were lawyers. And also, there were no lawyer jokes then because people respected lawyers, okay? People don't respect lawyers now because who could? You know, people don't respect doctors now either because you see them, you know, advertising. And there used to be just competing values. Not everybody wanted to be rich, or maybe everyone wanted to be rich, you know, but there were other ways. You know, this is, you know, human beings are not your finest species. You know, a lot of this is about status. There were other ways to gain status. You know, you had status as a doctor, you saved lives. You made more money than other people in a little town. The doctor would be one of the richest people, you know, but you, lawyers, you know, were not poverty stricken, but you, that was not the point of it. That was not the point of the respect, not at all. You know, not at all. And now that doesn't exist anymore. And it, you know, when I was young, when I first came to New York, I didn't even, other of the friends that I had when I was young, some of them were rich. You know, it took me like forever to notice this. Like, they weren't driving cabs like I was. No one talked about it. It wasn't really of interest to us. It just wasn't. The thing about money is that it's not that interesting. If you put it this way, what is money? Math. How fascinating is that? You know, but the entire country now has a reverence for it, a reverence for it. It's replaced every other value in the culture, including religious values. You know, I'm not talking about the crazy religious values people hold now. And I think the reason, one of the reasons for this extremism in religion is because to make noise over the money. The sound of money in this country is deafening. And it, of course, spread all around the globe. You know, because there's nothing more contagious than a bad idea. You know, a bad idea spreads in 1 second. A good idea takes centuries to bring people around to. So, yes, there used to be competing values. They're not here any longer. It's very hard. You know, you certainly can't restore values. It's not like a piece of furniture, you know. But the one thing that, you know, there are a lot of things about Occupy Wall Street that, you know, are not jibe with me. You know, I'm not as democratic as these people are. I'm not as interested in other people's opinions. And this is not confined to Occupy Wall Street, you know. But the idea that they have no hierarchy, which is a very old idea, of course, and by the way, in the end, not a very workable idea. The reason that it's a good idea this moment for these people is because when there's no hierarchy, when there's no leader or no dominant force, you have to have something else to show. It's not just automatic, you know. So, you know, everyone is hoping, I assume, at least I am hoping, that something like that will come out of this, you know. But if it doesn't, you know, people at this point have no choice but to have some other values, because I have really bad news for everyone. There's no money left. They took it all.
Now, I just want to remind people, we're talking to Fran Lebowitz. She's the author of Metropolitan Life and Social Studies, and subject of a documentary by Martin Scorsese that is still available, I think it's HBO, entitled Public Speaking. So, but Fran, I want to get back to this, because I cannot tell you how much I agree with this notion of the corruption of the professions. I do remember distinctly in my house, I was raised by a pack of lawyers. I remember, I don't know what age I was, but I do remember, the day that lawyers could advertise, because my father thought this was the end of the universe, and it was in
and he was right.
And I think he was right. But what led to this? And I think we saw this with journalism. I think we saw it with every single profession, where things that were, I guess, on some level, avocations, I mean, some type of calling in some way, became just commercialized and commodified, and where that value came from, rather than status in the society, because that's exactly I grew up basically thinking there were two ways to make money. It was either you become an attorney or you sell cars, and that was basically the division. You're either doing this because a profession that is part of the fabric of society, or it's just one just to make money. And what led to? I mean, what was there a cork that was sort of like pulled out of the bottle and all this came out? Was it just sort of an inevitability of capitalism? It gets to a certain point and it begins to eat away at the fiber of society. What led to that moment where you had those many lawyers or doctors who wanted to advertise?
I don't know. You know, I was myself, I think, I don't know what year that was, but if I wasn't a child, I was a young person. I don't know exactly what led to it, but I can assure you what led to it was lawyers and or doctors who wanted it. It's like airline deregulation. It's like all this deregulation. You know, the airlines fought and fought for deregulation. The airlines were deregulated not by Reagan, but by Jimmy Carter, which mm-hmm. no one seems to remember. They fought for this. They finally got it. Let me assure you, I mean, you probably don't remember flying before deregulation, but before airline deregulation, airlines were not allowed to compete on price. It was against the law. That was the regulation. Every single ticket to every single place was the same price. If you missed your plane, you know, to L.A. On one airline, the other airline happy to take your ticket, it was the exact same price. Hence, they competed on service. I'm sure you don't remember this, but they used to have ads, you know, fly with us, we have steak. No, fly with us, we have lobster. They fought for it. And I am positive, even though I do not know this, that airlines were generally more profitable. But what they weren't were open to everybody. Obviously, it was expensive to fly. You know, everyone wanted to fly. Now everyone does fly. Just at a point in time where, let's face it, there's no place to go. You know, it's a horrible mass transit system. It's very bad for the environment, if people still care about this at all. But the airlines fought for it, and now they're stuck with it, you know. And when there's all this kind of so-called competition, you know, for things, people who are younger than I am, who really, you know, seem to be consumed by, you know, acquiring services and objects and things like that, they spend an amount of time. When there was one phone company, which, believe me, we all hated, that was a phone company. You got your phone bill, that was the phone bill. I'm sure it was unfair, but that was it. But here's what you didn't do. Spend your precious time looking for phone plans.
Right.
You know, when there's a lot, what we have now is a tremendous amount of choice, you know, that is completely ersatz. You know, really, in the end, who cares what phone company you have? I don't. You know, what kind of phone you have? What difference does it make? You know, but people spend a lot of time doing this. People spend a lot of time looking for cheap airline tickets, too. You know, I mean, you only have so much time in life. I am going to tell this to anyone who's younger than me, which is probably everyone listening. You know, yes, the great thing about being young is you have time to waste. You know, time is the wealth of youth. You know, but really, to waste it on looking for a cheap airline ticket, you know, really, it's better off to waste it as we did in promiscuity.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's one of the things that one of the afflictions is that we have basically been taught that real achievement comes in your capacity as a consumer.
Yes. Well, there was I don't know at what point, you know, people started being called consumers as opposed to citizens. You know, I believe that the idea of basing the economy on people buying things happened after the Second World War, you know. It is, and that is why, if people would like think for one second, you know, when they read this stuff or hear this stuff, that is why this economy is not going to be restored. Because the people can buy things in one of two ways. They can afford to pay for them, which was never the case. It was never the case. This, you know, so-called great economy that we had, like, during the Clinton era, this was a debt-based economy.
Right.
So it was never the case that people could have all these things, you know, and pay for them. So it was a case where for a certain amount of time, they let them charge them, and then they can't charge them anymore. And now there's no jobs. So this is not coming back. You know, things are not going to come back. Things have to be new. You know, I keep hearing, you know, people, there's people that are very well motivated. You know, people that, you know, you feel, you know, an emotional connection to, you know, who say things, you know, we have to bring back, you know, factories in the Midwest and things like that. You know, that's not going to happen. But also, here's what's not going to happen. It's not going to happen that suddenly the population, which is composed mostly of average people, because that's what average means, is suddenly going to be composed of people who are, you know, mathematical geniuses. This problem is that all the work that average people can do, really, no one needs to be done anymore because these machines do this average work. But above average people are very few. And mostly it seems, and this is really something that is, I think, morally contemptible. You know, many of these people have spent the last 20 or 30 years just, instead of thinking up actually new great things, thinking up new horrible things. You know, financial instruments that are not only non-productive but are incredibly destructive, you know, or little variations on products. You know, everyone loves these things. I know they love them. You know, that is why everyone, you know, goes into mourning when Steve Jobs dies. You know, but these are not major contributions, you know, and this is not going to solve the problem.
Well,
the problem is that, first of all, people have to be willing to say they're average. The average Joe, a phrase that doesn't exist anymore, has disappeared. That disappeared and been replaced by this word middle class, which is not true and never was. You know, one of the things that people in this country did was always call what in Europe was called the working class the middle class. We never had a working class here after the Second World War. People who worked in factories were considered middle-class people. It doesn't matter, you know, in a certain way. People can call themselves what they like, but it is not true.
And what are the implications of calling it the middle class as opposed to the working class? I mean, because...
Well, the implication is that if everyone who was in the working class called themselves the working class, they would have noticed right away that there was no work, okay, instead of waiting till now to notice that there's no middle. Okay, it took a lot longer to notice there was no middle than to notice there was no work, you know, and that was the work that disappeared first, because those were the easier things to replace with machines, you know. Obviously, if someone does a kind of a job, you know, on an assembly line, that is a job that has already, you know, been sliced and diced, you know, by like Henry Ford, so that, you know, it's a simplified work, a very, by the way, unsatisfying kind of work for human beings, that work disappeared first. The actual middle class didn't care because they weren't doing it, you know. So if the people in the working class had known they were in the working class, which is actually, like I said, a horrible thing to be, would have noticed right away that their work disappeared, you know. And I don't think this union busting, which is detestable, would have been allowed. The hatred for unions in this country by people who should be in them is shocking to me.
Well, part of that happened as a function, I think. I mean, the sort of the spiral down from unions, I think, started, frankly, in the 70s or the late 60s, 70s, where you had that cleave between the social emancipation left, if you will, and the economic left. And in some respects, what we're seeing today, which I think is somewhat encouraging, is that it's sort of that coming back together, although with a much more anemic union movement by multiples of five or seven. We just have a couple of literally a couple of minutes, and I can't thank you enough for staying with me, because it's just I love to hear you talk. But let's just. If we continue on this track where we have an incredibly ultra-rich and then the majority, the vast, overwhelming majority of people down at the bottom, you know about the rich psyche as well as anyone I know who's willing to talk about it. What happens to those rich people? Does it even begin to register them, or do they just continue on enjoying what they have?
You know, what we have now in this country is something that the country, in my opinion, was founded to destroy, which is we have the irrevocably rich. You know, we have, you know, rich people who are irrevocably rich. They are incredibly, shockingly, stupidly rich, and they have manipulated the entire society to the point where they get people who don't even agree with them to call estate taxes death taxes, to, you know, this is how they keep the money. This is why we had that little war with England, by the way, to begin with. You know, so, you know, I think it doesn't look great to me unless people tell the truth. And one thing people should stop believing is that there are two kinds of rich people. You know, there's not two kinds of rich people. There's not the, you know, Warren Buffett who says, I want to pay more taxes, you know, is not, you know, some sort of delightful rich person. You know, Warren Buffett has a stupid amount of money, you know, and he is keeping that stupid amount of money. And, you know, he may be a nicer person, I don't know him, you know, than some other rich person, but basically he's in people's interests. You know, here's the thing. Here's my final answer. People used to identify by class. and I don't mean like class in England, but people used to, you know, think of themselves in connection to people who were in the same economic class as they were. And then at a certain point, everyone started identifying up, you know, and the way they did this was to get the average person, the majority of people, to identify with other aspects of themselves, you know, race, you know, sexuality, gender, all these things. You know, multiculturalism was a tremendous present to these Republicans and to these rich people, a tremendous present, because it took up 30 years while everyone sliced and diced themselves up into these little groups that have nothing to do with public life, that really have to do with your private life. You know, and so to me, the worst thing that happened was the many things that are public and many things that are private change places. You know, people don't even know the difference anymore. You know, so that is something that has to go back. People have to understand the difference between public and private, you know, and stop demanding things for their private life and demand things for their public life.
Fran Lebowitz, I believe you're a national treasure, and I can't thank you enough for coming on today and having this conversation with me, and I hope to do it again soon.